This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's not what it's done.
Why?
pattern from you, why it's been considered a good film, I say. Because as a filmmaker, I made the film as a means to try to change people's awareness, not to entertain anyone. So I'm really not the person to ask if you say, well, why is the film has any importance? I have to ask you more or less, why do you think it's what it is? Anyway, if you have any questions, I'll be
Charles, we're actually going to set you up in a nice, comfortable chair, and our colleagues Jason and Paul are going to pose a few questions to you, as well as the audience we hope will participate. So, make yourself comfortable. And Paul? Go ahead and make introductions.
Well,
we have so many people.
My name is Paul Young. I'm the director of the Film Studies program here at Vanderbilt, and I'm a professor in the English department as well. And my colleague Jason Morish is also in Film Studies, which is made up of about 35 faculty from 11 different departments in the college, and a few lecturers as well. Jason is, studies Spanish and Latin American film, primarily. We're really delighted to be here with you today, and I actually got to see Killer Machine for the first time pretty recently, since it's been such a difficult film to see for so many years, thanks to the problem, I take it primarily with the rights to the music, right? Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the film and how it is that, you know, just now it's coming out on video in a format that actually makes the film look, you know, something like it originally looked?
Well, initially, it was a piece of film. It wasn't made to be shown theatrically.
Right.
And so in making the film, I never considered putting the music rights because it wasn't going to be shown theatrically, so there wasn't a concern about it. As long as it was shown theatrically, I didn't have to pay for it.
Right.
It's on. Is it?
It's not.
Hello?
Hello?
I'm sorry, but he's a bit banged up too. Hello? Hello?
Yeah! You're right!
It was a thesis film, and at the time, I want you to know that there wasn't a means of distributing the film. And so it just showed in a neighborhood and some museums and schools, and that was it. And it wasn't until, this is like 1977 or something like that, and it wasn't until Milestone decided to release the film. And that they had to go back and renegotiate the rights for the music, and that took a while. And that's the reason why it took a while. A long time to find distribution because of music.
Was the film ever shown stripped of the soundtrack or stripped of the music? Just
no, never shown okay. Without the music.
Okay. Well, one of the questions I had just to sort of move into that would be about how you chose the music for the film, because you know we've got Dinah Washington, we've got a few Paul Robeson songs, some Gershwin, you know, Hot Vibes, and what was it, West End Blues? That's one of the most, I think, effective things about the soundtrack, and I think there are lots of amazingly effective bits about the film that really just kind of sneak up on you. But one of the great things is, you know, this bitter earth with Stan dancing with his wife, and he progressively, you know, actually puts his arms around her very, very slowly, but then he walks away at the end, kind of picking up from the kind of blankness that he feels when he's at home. You talked about this film being the story of someone who arrives at the truth, but you didn't want to frame the story in a Hollywood structure. What do you think is the truth that he's looking for, or that you were looking for? Because the film isn't interested in motivations, so like telling us the motivations of the characters the way that a Hollywood film would just be obsessed with it. And the music seems to me to give us some hints and clues to emotional states that they're not able to express or just not willing to express to each other.
Well, the music was something that I used to listen to because my mother played it a lot, you know. And eventually, it was something I didn't really appreciate at the beginning because, you know, I was really into the blues at the time when I was a kid. But it wasn't until sometime later when I was an adult that I sort of got interested in the blues in a sense because I was, you know, walking down the street and I hear, you know, there's melodies that were going in my head, you know, and I remember where they came from. And so I started listening to my mother's old records again with these big 78s, you know. And then images sort of emerged from listening to them. And I had, you know, played the trumpet when I was a kid and things like that, so I knew about, you know, about music, about W.C. Handy and the singers, blues and things like that. But I really didn't really appreciate it until, I think the blues is something that, and until you get older, you really understand them much better because you sort of live through those experiences and things. And so when I was in my class in music too, and so it's sort of like an eclectic kind of a situation. And those weird Grant Still I used a lot as well, and African-American symphony. And some other pieces. And Paul Robeson, for example, I put in a sort of ironic place because there were these kids playing in the stadium lot. It's what is a narrative to me. And so it was a counter what you were seeing, and also the fact that, you know, Paul Robeson was a person I really admired, you know, and he was blacklisted and so that the lyrics said in the narratives to me, so there was a lot of irony in that, you know, in that scene. And about Stan, I wanted to do a story that didn't reflect I wouldn't use the black point of view, but what had happened was I had been working with independent filmmaker at UCLA who made films about the working class. And most of them, in fact all of the kids who made the films were well-to-do kids, you know. And they lived in Beverly Hills and Brooklyn and they would make these films about exploitation, you know, and it would be the same story about managing exploiting workers, you know, some sort of shop situation, and then the workers would form a union, and everything would be resolved and happy.
At the end of a sitcom.
Yeah, but it was progressive in ways, and it was, you know, an interesting, you know, to people in Hollywood, so, you know, these people were conscious of what was going on in the community. But they weren't the people that I knew. And so it was that, and the fact that I wasn't exactly radical, but I had a little tendencies in it. And
it was California in the 60s.
The 70s. And remember two things happened. I used to go to this barbershop, and these older guys would be there. And they were in the South. They experienced a lot. They experienced a lot of stuff that I never even imagined. And so it was a day when it was like Paul Robeson's birthday or something. And you know, I was under the illusion that everyone was interested in Paul Robeson and celebrate his birthday, so I go into the barbershop. And it's always a little discussion in these barbershops. So I found that these guys were that these two barbers, first one guy, and they admired him as an artist, not as an American, because they felt that his speaking against America, opposing America, was wrong, and that I couldn't understand. And so we had this big argument, and that was, and in fact, instead of that, if they bought me a ticket to Russia, they would buy me a ticket to Russia, but I promised not to come back. We were arguing, you know, such a point. The other thing was, And having gone to UCLA and from the community, you sort of realize that you've changed in many ways. And how you look at things completely different from the kids I grew up with and didn't go to school. And so we argued about a lot of things. And you know, at the time, also that there was this notion that you know, you spoke for the black community, you know. And in reality, you didn't even speak for yourself, but at least that was the notion of something. But I realized that that wasn't the case. And so I wanted to do a film where that would, if someone saw it, you know, that they would say, yeah, that's that, you would see that in the community. And out of that, and putting these elements together, you would see in the community that it would form a narrative that would have a sense of chronology. And not necessarily a beginning and end, but a movement in some way. And that there really is no ending to it, just that life is this thing that you have to endure. And there's positive moments, negative moments, and sort of a balance. But the thing about it is that you arrive at the fact that Sam's going to be who he is, and then he hasn't caved into all these negative images and things in the community, and then he's going to survive. That's all you can say in the film, basically. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, you can make a film that, you know, he goes back to school, becomes a doctor, whatever it is, and then he becomes successful, and then he gets a car, and then Sugar Hill, or Sugar Hill, whatever. And, I mean, that would have been interesting, but, you know, it wouldn't have been real, and it would have been presumptuous on my part to say, if you do this and that, this will happen. Because I had arguments from the kids in the neighborhood, they were not smarter than I was. You know. And we couldn't, you know, come to the conclusion of how to resolve these issues. And I found myself unable to help people with that. Because I had a lot of friends that were in need, you know. And then I'm making a film that's trying to talk about these problems and these issues and saying that I'm not trying to tell them what to do, because another thing that made me do the film that I did was, in a way, was I got money to do the film from a grant. It was a little money. And a friend of mine asked me, could he borrow some money? Could he borrow some money? Was anyone in need town? And I was sort of, caught between the bull and the wall, in the sense that if I loaned him the money, I wouldn't be able to do the film. And so it was still like a toss-up, you know. And so I realized I wouldn't, here I had an opportunity to help someone I didn't do the film. So all those things came together to make the film what I was thinking about. That impacted on the film.
Did you find yourself consciously trying to avoid some pitfalls of Hollywood plotting, cause and effect, and psychological motivation, and always being kind of singular, and I've got one goal on my mind, and that's what I'm going to go for? Or did you start really with the images and just let them start to build what's the story you want to tell?
No, one of the things at UCLA at the time was it was anti-Hollywood. Yeah. If you wanted to be in Hollywood, you went to SC. and it was very structured there, but UCLA was very interestingly chaotic, in the sense that, the teachers were irreverent in some sense. They were on the same scale as anybody else, in some sense. You sort of learned from other students rather than, the teachers were sitting around. And that's what it seemed like, because you only saw them at the end, but there was this notion, do you say, that it was sort of anti-Hollywood. It was very clear to yourself. Mm-hmm. Anytime Hollywood people came up to make their films, they were visually attacked. And the other thing was that they gave you cameras and they brought me a film and come back with something I hadn't seen. And the other thing I think that was one of the most important things, was the fact that they didn't want you to adopt your film. You know, and no one really did. And, I mean, there were some kids who did, you know. But most of them were trying to make personal films. So that really helped me with it, too. And one of the other things that I think was very important to me was the fact that there was a teacher by the name of Basil Wright, who was there at the time. He was really
documentary.
He wrote the documentary. Because when I got these, you know, I got these, they came from a community with Richard Block. And so these kids were making film. Well, they had they did have this early quarter screening in UCLA, the Gross Hall screens, which were the best films at UCLA in the quarter of screening. And this big auditorium called Gross Hall. And I used to go, and this is before I made films. I was taking classes there before I got into the film department. And I can identify with the films. Because it was the time when it was in the 60s when there were hippies and things like that, you know, and a lot of children. And they're making these films about nudity and running in the woods and doing all sorts of stuff. And they couldn't see me on the light shows and stuff. And I said, God, this filming, I'm never going to do it, but I can do it. I don't have those sensibilities, you know. But I was in this documentary class. That's right. He made songs and all. It was a really wonderful documentary. And luckily he was there because I guess spoke to him at some point about it. And it was very encouraging, you know. He just reminded me of film was about, you know. And I can't remember exactly what he said, but I remember just conversation with him and going in the direction that I wanted to go in. So he was very key.
And your films have been compared so often to, you know, Italian media where it was a film from right after the war, and I'm getting a little tired of hearing about that. But it does obviously have a real documentary quality, particularly since you're filming on location. You're working with, you know, I take it just mostly friends of yours from the neighborhood from Watts.
Yeah, but I think it was I think documentary films, I think, played a large part because it's really interesting in sort of local documentary films, like the ones that not only that Public Flaherty was working, and also Juris Evans, like P.L. Rounds and the Hollywood play and all that stuff like that. And sort of a miracle with music and rhythm and things like that. And also the fact that there were photographs so well. I want to kill a sheep that's a little. Have the fact that you were, I mean, I just put the camera down in the middle of the street to shout what was going on, and that it was a documentary. Yes. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't. I'm going to give it a sort of illusion that it was a documentary.
I could ask you questions all day, but I give Jason the chance to ask
you. Well, since you mentioned documentary filmmaking, I'm wondering about some of the similarities between Latin American film from the 1960s and 70s, and your own films. And one of the questions that comes to mind is Latin American filmmakers of that period tended to find themselves firstly as revolutionary filmmakers, and maybe secondly as Latin American or national filmmakers. And race tended to be a secondary concern also, although it was present in the project. And so I'm wondering if in the late 70s you considered yourself primarily a black filmmaker or a revolutionary filmmaker.
One second, I'm shaking
with it. Please. Yes.
excuse me. Well, actually, it was interesting because it wasn't until this idea of the third world film came about, and one of the interesting things at UCLA was the fact that there was a teacher by the name of Alison Taylor who would introduce third world films in a class that he created called Film and Social Change. And we got a chance to see a lot of Latin American films, and which really Jimmy is tremendous and what a shame the line was, you know, because it was the sort of stuff that we wanted to do. I think more than anything else, it was a lot of the films from countries like Latin America that really, was responsible for shaping the number of the filmmakers that came out of UCLA in the 50s and 70s. Yeah, and I think what it was that you mentioned about this whole notion about black films and black filmmakers. We spent a lot of time, you know, trying to define what was or what is a black film. You know, and I sort of random way that I tried to explain that this is one of our biggest issues we had, and what prevented us from going forward was this constant debate about what is a black film, because we couldn't get off that, you know, in a certain sense. It sort of was a positive and a negative in a certain way. Because we were excluding people because if they didn't have a film that we thought was a black film, you know, he was gone, you know. And so that created a lot of friction and tension and so forth.
Well, I mean, it's interesting you say that because in my brother's wedding, I see social class as just as central to the film as race. I don't know if that's how you intended it, but it really came across that way to me, with all the tensions inside the film between the characters.
Well, it was a different approach, I think, in many ways. I did Kill a Sheep, and you know, there was a series that Pearl Bowles and Arnold Franklin put together that toured the films throughout the country, and we went to Milwaukee and places like that, and all over, and in the community. And we found that this life in my particular film was the fact that people looked at it with that and said, well, there's no humor, there's no this and that, and it's about, you know, this particular segment of life, you know, this particular group of people. And people wanted to see themselves, and so there's all this, you know, there's a huge range of experiences in my community, and so I mean, class and things like that, and so I wanted to do something that wasn't so much about the stand kind of, you know, working poor or standing was in a way, but someone just a little bit above that, in a sense. But also the fact that there was some change in the community as well, in terms of, when I grew up in Los Angeles, there was a sort of southern sort of atmosphere. And everyone was from some part of the South, Mississippi, Arkansas, Texas, all those places like that. And it reflected those values, those southern values, and, you know, there were folk ways and things and storytelling and that sort of thing. And in the sense of an extended family, people owned their homes, there were people who, you know, had trades. And then, and when I started to do my first wedding, that started to change. And I was looking back at that particular point of who are these people now, in some sense. And Pierce represented the main character that they represent. That film represents a person who he has good intentions, but in many ways, he isn't focused. And I thought that was a dangerous thing for a person to be in the community, in the sense that if you were going to be responsible for someone, you can't be mature. You know, and I met a lot of people who, there's a lot of friends of mine, who had, you know, didn't have these capacities in a certain sense, didn't have the means of giving good advice, anything like that. So the character of Pierce was someone like I mentioned who had been indigenous, but had the, for example, he romanticized the poor and had this rather negative distortion of the middle class, and instead of taking both the world, I mean, the positive from both worlds, the best of both worlds, he was sort of caught in the middle, and which created this tragedy or sad thing in the end. And so it was about more and where the community was, that what was headed for, and then when I didn't sleep with anger, it was another aspect, another time in the community where it was.
That's something I'd actually like to ask about too. We talk about to sleep with anger. there are certain themes in your films that kind of get picked up, but they're changed, obviously, as you've just been talking about. There's the theme of family being crucial, but also agonizing. the theme of the intermingling of like pretty great migration from rural culture with urban neighborhoods like Watts, and things like self-representation versus racism. One of the things that I really love about Killer of Sheep is that there seems to be this motif of people looking at themselves in mirrors, whether it's just the shiny back of a pot, when Stan's wife just suddenly catches a glimpse of herself, or when she's working on her eyelashes, but there's Stan does that as well. How do you see your themes evolving over the years? Does it depend on subject matter, or does it really depend on what you see as kind of authentic experiences that are changing or your relationships to these issues like family and the rural past might be changing?
I think it's a combination of a number of things. Images for one, and what I'm interested in, but the community has changed, and I'm sort of up to certain points of sort of reflecting those changes in these three of my films, Killer Sheep, My Pennsylvania, and The Sleep of Anger.
Yeah. The Sleep of Anger feels much more kind of mythological.
Well, it was, again, there was an aspect of it that was missing, I found, this is the photo world. That in a sense of a family, an extended family, and I hear people talk about how what it used to be like, that we used to take our grandparents and things like that, and now we put them in homes now and things like that. But it was also this conflict of folkways that I think was sort of troubling at certain points. And also the thing about that was that when I was coming up, you sort of had those ideas in the community, folkways, and a lot of us didn't accept that, as kids, it was like old fashioned and stuff like that, and people do all these strange things. And as you get older, you sort of come back to it, So maybe there is some truth to these things, And you begin to respect them in a certain sense, and you realize how important they are, and you don't want to see them disappear, and so you bring them up as issues in films, and this is what I did with Sleep with Anger. Because I came up with, my mother's generation of people had these emotions, and you could go back to them, as an adult, and you realize that, that they do have value.
Film and folklore, most of the art forms have a lot in common. They're telling ourselves about ourselves.
Particularly when they sort of work in a sense, for example, I was in Korea shooting the film, and I got ill, and we were shooting a film about covered women, these women who used to sex slaves in Japan, and what happened was my sound person had this call they gave to everybody, this really vicious call. And so this lady, this elderly lady said, she looked at me and said, you're her ill. And so she said, let's stop and let me go to the drugstore and get you some herbs and things like this. This was in Korea. And so I said, okay, you know, I didn't believe it was going to happen. Anyway, so she came back and she pricked my finger and took this piece of thread, tied it around, pulled her real tight, you know, and did the same thing, pricked my finger and squeezed the blood out, and put a scanner on it and pulled it real tight. And I swear to you, in a short period of time, you know, you start to feel different, you know. And first of all, you think, well, sort of like one of these placebo effects, you know, it's psychological, it's just a power thing. And so you think of that, you know. And she said, no, I'm actually feeling very good. and then toward the end of the day, you're feeling good again. And the next day, you're having cold. And then the guy who gave it to you is just totally out of it, you know. And actually, he was creative and refused to do it, you know. And he didn't believe it. But it's those kind of things, you know, that you really have to respect it, you know. And I think, I wanted to speak with anger, to call attention to us as people losing that.
Actually, I was just going to mention, sort of following, made me think of one scene that I was really interested in my brother's wedding. When Pierce, the main character, he's talking to, I think, his grandparents, who's taking care of them at home. Right? He's tending to them, and in the right-hand part of the screen, there's this foreshortened image of a boxing match going on. This is such a fantastic image, and I just sort of wanted to go, I know this is sort of very specific, I'm asking for a very specific commentary here, but
the director's.
It seemed to me such an important moment, but I couldn't put into words why.
Well, the TV, the boxing match, was, I had to put it in some angle, you couldn't really see, because it was an ABC, and, you know, they had a wonderful sport thing, whatever it was, at the time, and you couldn't really see how much you get in trouble, you know, you had to pay for it, because somebody could be as big as possible, but if you just on the edge of the frame, you know, that you would see it, but not really see it, and that sort of thing. But I think that's the book of Pierce, who was good by the fact that he had this kind of family, he had to do these things, you know, and that kept him from actually being like a soldier, another, you know, a person who was totally void of feelings and emotions and things like that. But no, that was just basically showing. You know, a person from the South still has those obligations to deal with an extended family.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to open it up to the
questions from the group. Thanks. Yes.
Hi, I have a broad question. What would you say to young Black filmmakers today, since the industry is so bottom line oriented in this economy right now? And I feel, you know, compassion for some of our brothers and sisters who feel the pressure to imitate the old destructive Hollywood stereotypes just to be able to recoup their investment. And what would you say, how would you encourage them to keep the focus on the whole reason you make films in the first place?
It's hard. I don't make films that often. And things like that. You know, it's you know, when Hollywood comes along, it becomes very attractive, you know, to you know, get a job, you know. I don't know if it's worth it. I just did a film at this company, it was a TV film, and of cable, and it was a good story. But it was like cookie cutter. You were just hired to write to, or your job was just to say action and cut, basically. You know? And the producer had a certain way of shooting. He was going to edit the film, and so he's going to be his own cut. You didn't have anything to do with casting, basically. maybe do anything. I mean, as a director in the film, you have a lot of control. You know, you can cast, you do, have shoots and shoot what you want to, basically. You get the location, you can want changes, how they have changes in the budget, things like that. They refuse to change the color, put it wrong, but what are we doing for it? We can't totally do it because we're going to use this set again for another film, and it was always used, so we couldn't do anything. And I ran into a wall on that, and it was the worst experience I ever had as a person. And I just shut down, and my system just stopped. I would get on the set, and I couldn't think of anything. I read right at, I knew what I wanted to do and act. But when I got to the set, it was just a blank. It was a total blank. It was like I never run the film set before. And I mean, you get, what do you call this, teeth thing, your jaw starts to get. Yeah, whatever it was, I got that, about to get it, and all these other things, And,
director's block.
And so when I left that film, I was like so happy. And but the problem is that wouldn't be the way filming is going now, because this guy gets a lot of work. I mean, this company is a big company, and they do a lot of films, but it's unrewarding. If you just want to make money, you can do that. But, it's no point in doing it if you can't say what you want to say and make the film you want to say, you can sleep better at acting and other things, because this is a really difficult business to be in, as you know. I mean, I had hair one time. I didn't think it was black, I was kind of some 80s part of it, but still, I felt like I can keep it, and I was positive on it, And so I would say that, I would tell any filmmaker, to mind them something that would pay for, if you want kids and things like that, or a house and stuff like that, you have to take it seriously, because most of us don't make films that often. And all the filmmakers I know who would have any kind of success, I can name them, but I wouldn't. They're not working there, and they're calling constantly asking about jobs. These people with experience who've done films. I would avoid telling them anything. I would say, don't talk to me. Let me shoot me here around, come from me. But I would say that if you want to learn as much as you can and craft, and just be prepared. It's not going to be an easy job. You may be lucky, but if you go straight to the studio system, you can probably do it. The funny thing is, maybe it's an art generation that they don't accept. And I say this because, they have these programs in the studios now that you could, these director, what has it done? To do episodic TV, Disney has this thing where, you can apply, like over 500,000 people applied for, they were able to take through, right? And so all these people apply, and some of us older experience people apply and get turned down, And so because Tony really wants to do TV now, episodic television, because it's very simple, it's easy to do in some sense. And it's quick and it's easy money, and that's it. Some other shows are very good. And I just mentioned this other show, but this is a different production company. And Scott was a megalomaniac and Aaron and all and stuff like that. And he wanted to control everything. But generally those TV shows, a lot of people want to do because it's money, And so a lot of us applied and someone said, you should apply this time. You should apply. Okay, so I applied. And I got into the finalists and stuff like that. And I went to a meeting and I said, well, what are you doing here? I said, why? I want to do this on TV. Well, do you have to go this? I mean, all the people who were applying knew me were, and it's like, oh, you're cheating because, you know, you have all this experience and stuff and so forth, you know. And I said, well, but I had talked to the people earlier, and they said, well, you know, you really should apply because, you know, you don't have to go through this. Maybe we'll find another round for you to get in. I still haven't heard from them, right? But I know some other people, like some people I'll mention their names, that I've had when they were trying to get in the program, had a lot of experience and didn't make it to the final, you know. And so I asked one, I said, well, why wasn't this person, you know, accepted in this program? And they said, well, she hasn't done a film recently. You know, the stuff she's done is old. But she still has experience more than any of the kids that were accepted, you know. But I don't know how I got on this, but anyways, it's hard to for a filmmaker. You just have to have the passion when I do it. Yes.
I think it's a great time for independent filmmakers in many ways. There are a lot of avenues for distribution, and the cost of filmmaking has come down. I was wondering, from your perspective, having done it for so many decades, what would you say are some of the biggest, you know, perhaps along with all those benefits or things that are easier about doing it now, or things that are maybe more challenging or more difficult, you know, greater obstacles in some ways. And I thought you could shed light on that.
Would you be the first one about distribution or something?
There are more, you know, avenues for distribution, I guess, for filmmakers now. That's, you know, seems to be the case.
I don't know. I'm not sure if there's some people who get distribution, but most of the people I know is it's a very difficult part of filmmaking. We have a film that's going to say tomorrow, and we're trying to get distribution for. I worked on a number of films, and from the film management officially, that was very good. We still have yet to get distribution. That's been three or 4 years, you know. I think it's the hardest part of filmmaking. It's more or less maybe easier with the funding. But at the same time, to get the funding, you should probably have distribution where you get the funding. You know, it's somewhat easier. I think there's an illusion that it's easier in the sense that there's digital cameras and editing things out there. But anybody has the capacity to do that. That doesn't mean that all those films are worth seeing. I mean, a few of my friends have been on the film festival says he gets hundreds and hundreds of these digital ways of filming. And he said, that's great. He said, you don't want to see them. I'm sure there's names of digital films on the internet and things like that and so forth. And then you have to look at that as a new film. But in terms of the actual release, it's hard to get space.
Do you think that's harder now?
I think it's harder now. I think it's a lot harder now. I mean, there used to be archives and things like that. This looked like, and they're always all the theaters are dominated by Hollywood films. You know, we go to France, I argue the same thing. They can't get their films local. Films in the theater because of the language. So distribution is hard. Everywhere you go, it's always an issue about distribution. There are some people who manage to get distribution. But there's a lot of films that are made on the show. You know, they buy on Sundance, and you never hear from them again, you know. Or they come out quickly and they're gone, you know. And if the film, you know, isn't doing well in the first couple of days. It used to be when I was in the term of distribution, it used to be like the first couple of weeks. It used to be, and then because now it's the first couple of weeks, and we thought that was short. You know, now it's like opening night if it's like no one goes, the next night is so it's dead. I don't know if that answers your question.
I mean, to a great extent, it sounds like you're saying distribution is harder. And that theatrical releases are much more difficult than they used to be. That was my question.
What's
more difficult now in your experience, you know, versus, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago in the film business?
Well, it's about 20 years ago. In the late 60s, it was the early 60s, there was two people that took me from my room in Italy because I lived at the Union CMI. I was there, you know, I wasn't doing that. I mean, there were warehouses and things like that. And there were these things in the like, oh, films at midnight, you just in film and like, places like that and so forth, you know. But after I think it ends somewhere around the end, right? You had, I think, a bit more opportunity to probably get your own distributor. If not, you actually sell it to like, European TV, because a lot of our films were shown and bought by German television in England and France and things like that. And so we got distribution that way. And so there was that small market, you know. And yeah.
How does new technology influencing distribution opportunities? The internet, digital downloading?
Well, I think most of us look to the camera films, you know, as a way of getting out to the public, you know, through the internet. Because it's a new part, I mean, one of the things that Hollywood tells you when they want this new, try to push a story there is that, no one's interested in black film. You know, we can't sell in Europe, we can't sell in Japan, we can't, they always say that, you know, basically. And the theory of the whole world, you know, and like you don't have to you know, if you can get, you know, 0.5% of the world, I mean, on the internet, those who would buy your DVD, you've done great, you know. And so that possibility is, I mean, it's very good, you know, market on the internet. But, yeah, I mean, it's making the film out there. But I think that one of the things about film that I like and the possibility that you show it in an environment like this, in a theater, where it's a social thing, you know. And somehow, it's a different experience when the film is shown in a group setting as opposed to someone watching it alone on a small box, a small screen, and things like that. Because it's a film that you sort of, you'll be thinking in a larger frame.
So how do you reconcile those artistic sensibilities with business realities?
Well, this is the thing that's struggling in a way, because young people today look at movies on certain size of this, you know, from the iPads, you know, and you look at it and say, what the heck, you know, and you have shoes in that in mind as well, you know.
Safe area.
Yeah, you have to look at all those different formats and things, you know, which I think, I think the bad part about it, maybe because I came up when, you know, from was seen on the big screen. It's supposed to, I'm an American, it's supposed to be seen on the big screen. I tell you what, my film part of the projector as opposed to the television, you know. And we can project it on our front and our walls because it's, you know, like a little theater. And that is such an experience. I mean, I think the older DVDs, the older ones and that, you know, and they look good. When they project it, I really like to watch it. When I see my television, I don't really care. But that's me. But when you see these kids now, they're going to look at these little things like that. And so it doesn't matter to them, the sound to anything. You know, it's like, I think black and white is a really a beautiful form in a film to work in. You try to show black and white to a kid now, and you get your writing nuts. I don't see that. That's not a movie.
I mentioned that negative course evaluations.
Yeah, it's awful, you know, but yeah, I think new technology will really help in a similar way. I think people who are distributing directly granted to in these TV selling places, maybe These
buildings.
Video stores, we have like
Costco and
Costco store and these other places, you know, like that. And what's a Blockbuster, the ones like that. So there's new avenues to distribute films. But the thing is, you know, the money back to try to
Charles, In To Sleep With Anger, the first time I watched that, the characters, whether they had a very small part or larger parts, going to the Lego with Danny Glover, reminded me of every friend that my mother and father had growing up as a child. Every character, even down to the wardrobe of these characters, particularly at the party scene. How did you go about bringing these characters to life? And how, can we talk a little bit about that? Because it just seemed to be so spot on. Even though I know that this is I'm from the South, I'm from Tennessee, and I know this is a Southern family migrated to L.A., it just seemed to be so spot on.
Well, you know, you sort of observe people, you know, and you sort of, you know, look back and find these interesting people. Like, I'm not from the middle class family, just the opposite of the way, you know. Lots of the time, that before the civil rights movement, everyone sort of lived together in the middle class, and there was all right there, in a sense. There's all this entrapment to sort of see and witness, you know, and so just a matter of drive from, people seeing and experience, and that's all. People are interesting, and there's all these characters walking around, that belong in the movie. So in that sense, it's very easy to draw from. You see the story, and I think that's one of the things that we tried to do as filmmakers in UCLA. We were trying to define what is the story, what is the black story, and how we represent these people, and so again, it came down with a lot of searching and debates about the nature of film.
This is something that you've kind of you've danced around for this whole conversation. You mentioned earlier that when you were filming your thesis film, that your goal necessarily wasn't to entertain your audience, but to affect some change. Mm-hmm. And then what change, more or less, were you trying to bring about back then? And how has that either changed or perpetuated throughout your career?
One of the things is that you wanted to just show people as human beings, and also people kind of see themselves, which they couldn't do in a Hollywood film as such. But there were a few films that were very good, you might say. But in general, it was always a negative stereotype, and that's what we rebelled against, And what we were doing was a larger number of shows, less alike, that these people are human. For example, when I screened Sleep With Anger, I forget what country I was in, and a person in the audience asked me two things. So one, I don't know black people have washing machines, and you say, because I remember when I first saw a film made by Jack Neely, and it wasn't real question to me until then. There was a lot of other propaganda films about the Japanese in the war and all something like that. instead of journeying and things like that, we see them seemingly beings. It just broadens your horizon, awareness, you know, and expands your humanity. When I saw like films by others or Kurosawa or something like that, and other great Chinese filmmakers, I thought I was robbed by this country for not betraying these people, you know. And same thing with the Native American, you know. And I just happened to be in the movie when the Sphinx was showing, sitting next to a film writer who's Native American, and when the scene when this lady skipped down the hill, this Native American, the Indian skipped down the hill, she didn't want to walk down. And I was sort of unaware, I was like, so what happened? And she said, well, did you see that? And I said, oh, that, yeah. You know, and the other thing in this screening of this stigmatizer, another person asked the question, well, why are you drugs in your army? You know? And I said, what do you mean, though? You know? There's no gangsters and drugs. And I said, what? I mean, that's not the sum total of the community, drugs and that sort of thing like that. In fact, when I was shooting in Africa, one of the ladies said, if I go to whatever place, what place in the States, will I get killed? You know? But they have this perception, you know, that we are, you know, these people in Hollywood can, you know, create. And so a lot of us at the time were trying to counter, you know, these stereotypes and things like that. And it's not, I mean, you're just making films where people are just being themselves, you know, is enough, you know. And because, you know, when those black exploitation films came about, you know, but just seeing a black person on screen was revolutionary in a certain sense, you know. And in spite of that, later on, it would go sort of negative, but I remember people were so happy to see, you know, things like Superfly and all this kind of stuff, you know. And I don't know.
You take one more question, Paul. Two more questions.
I agree with you about the big screen, that there's nothing like the big screen and enjoying viewing, you know, in the community. My first experience with your work was almost 10 years ago at a high school, East New York, in Brooklyn. I was a teaching artist there with a class that was an incredibly rough class. Rival gangs within the class. And To Sleep With Anger was used as a teaching tool with them. And it was amazing how it transformed the class. The class put together a rendition of To Sleep With Anger and talked about how it actually brought about community, you know, within the rival gangs. It was amazing. So my question is, even though the big screen, there's nothing like it, have you considered or are you opposed to scholastic distribution, in that your work is a great teaching tool, everything you've done, including Namibia.
I've done documentaries that are circulating in schools and things like that, and I think it's great, and as much as it's been funny, you know, I was doing this document on Reconstruction. I was working with these scholars, and so one of the, we had just met, you know, this guy had given me his work and to look at, and it sells into all different libraries and schools in the country, right? And so I saw his tapes and like that, and I dismissed them, you know. And so some poor lady asked me, says, and he said, did you see my... No, I asked him just for a conversation, because, and I said, how's your film doing? He said, great, great. And he said, yeah. And he said, well, I'm selling them. It was like five or four shorts, like 50 minutes a piece, for like a package of like $500. And I was like, you sold those to the family? And they were really, I don't want to sound arrogant, but they were really bad. They were really, just amateurish. And I was shocked at that. But he told me, he sold them to all these different schools and universities and libraries. And I started counting, trying to count how many there are in this country. You know? And I was like, that is a lot of money. That is a lot of money. And it wasn't much creative, imaginative stuff in it. It's almost like these picture drawings, you know, you see these paintings of people with their mouths open screaming, you know, and stuff, and you see this drawing gunfire and stuff. I said, dang. And it's amazing. But it is a great market, you know, and I gotta get back to that. Glad you reminded me of that. So I just started doing those stick figures and coming. I'm serious, you know? Yeah, but we have been getting that, and I think Third World News does that as well. We get the films from Third World News, they're supposed to send it out to all the different venues like that as well.
One more question.
Good market, yeah.
This is really a kudo. I just want to thank Mr. Burnett for the integrity that he's been able to maintain in his artistic form, because the work is brilliant, and I know that with your talent, it could have been easier to go the commercial route. But I always really respect people who maintain their artistic integrity, even if it means in different jelly sandwiches. But having said that, you know, there is certainly so much more work to be done, particularly in educating the world about the breadth of character and personality and psychology of different groups. I'm reminded of the fact that just recently I had an opportunity to work with Native American children. And I never worked with Native American children before. And it was such an eye-opener. And I thought, gee, there should be a film about this culture somewhere. I mean, so I just hope that you and other filmmakers will take the opportunity to really explore those untapped territories.
Well, I think it takes an audience to make need to get aware of the other problems. And I think the film festival, one of the perks of the film festival is to do that, and use the community, to cultivate the community, and understand and promote these films, make them more available. But there is a Native American film that's out now called Exiles, that Ken McKenzie and Miles Brown distributed. That film was quite extraordinary film.
It screened here recently. At the same theater that your film will be screened in.
Yeah, I recommend that kind of thing.
Well, I think we're running kind of, but at least conclude this portion of our program. Let's give Charles a hand.